People might be shaken to wake to the news today of the nation's downgraded credit rating. But yesterday's unemployment report reflects a more personal impact for many Americans. Not having a job in the United States can feel like getting punched in your stomach every morning. It can literally ache and take your breath away. There are lots of people who may disappear in the monthly unemployment numbers. The Bureau of Labor Statistics classifies 8.4 million Americans as involuntary part-time workers. These are men and women who may have worked a little over the past year, a few weeks in a store just before Christmas, or in a restaurant during the spring travel season, but nothing since because those stores and restaurants aren't hiring full-time staff. Involuntary part-time workers have probably run out of the money they earned. They may have no health care coverage and may have to live with infirmities and pains they can't afford to fix. They fear their children might get sick. Or worse, they may have a child who is sick and have to figure out what to do without, what meals they can skip, what shoes they can make last, to pay for them to be treated. They need and want full-time work. They make phone calls, send resumes, and go to interviews. But lots of people are looking for work today. When Caterpillar opened hiring this summer in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, 4,000 people applied for 329 jobs. When the Plaza Hotel in Las Vegas opened 300 jobs this summer, 8,000 people applied. With odds like that, at least a few other applicants are usually a little more experienced. Or more embarrassing, there are others who apply who are less experienced, but younger, single, and willing to work for less. Then there are 2.8 million people the Bureau of Labor Statistics label discouraged workers. They've looked for work over the past year, but not in the 4 weeks before the survey. They haven't won the lottery. They've been told no so many times in a year or gotten no response to their phone calls, emails, or visits that they just stop looking because it seems useless. Hearing no after no, day after day, isn't just discouraging. It's hurtful and humiliating. After a year or two of being knocked around and doing without, how many of us who were blessed to have jobs would even get out of bed to be so downgraded? Economists of all persuasions point out that everyone without a job is one more person who can't help fuel the economy to recover. America misses out not only on their money, but the energy, ambition, and experience of millions of people when the country can use them most. You're listening to NPR News. Peter Spiegelman loves a good caper. Well, he did work on Wall Street for 20 years before becoming a writer, but he says the inspiration for his new novel, Thick as Thieves, are some of the classic caper films in which people, under pressure, race to make a lot of money and always wonder whom they can really trust.
I need you to bridge some burglar alarms, open doors, cut some telephone circuits. I got a job laid out.
Want to knock over a casino? Three casinos?
You gotta be nuts.
Exactly.
150 million.
Smash and grab job, huh?
Slightly more complicated than that.
Top Cappy is an impregnable fortress. Those emeralds are watched day and night.
So over here in this room, you can take 100 million off the wall and waltz right out the front door. Oh, that's good.
Signature lines from The Anderson Tapes, Ocean's 11, Top Cappy, and The Thomas Crown Affair. Peter Spiegelman has written three thrillers since leaving Wall Street 9 years ago. He's being acclaimed for bringing some of the hands-on expertise and literary grace that John le Carré brought to espionage novels to stories of capers, heists, and double crosses. Peter Spiegelman joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Is there anything we'd see in a caper film that winds up in your book?
I love the sound bites that you selected. They're from some of my favorite films. And I think the vibe, you know, more than anything else, I think what I was trying to capture here is the vibe of the exotic, the paranoid, of that tension that is constantly ratcheting up, of people who are, you know, wrestling in their own ways with that central question of whether or not there is honor among thieves.
The target at the center of your story is Curtis Prager, and he's rich and corrupt. How does he make his money?
He had been a sort of storied hedge fund manager. His hedge fund went south under allegations of fraud and the general market collapse. But rather than being chastened by any of that, he sort of embraced his inner pirate and got into a business that ostensibly is about buying small bank and trust companies, consolidating their operations, consolidating their back offices that he runs from the Cayman Islands. What he's actually involved in is providing a kind of a financial superstore for black money. So he does everything from money laundering to investments to shell corporations.
I've got to ask you while we have the opportunity here. It seems to me that in recent years, not just since 2008, people who work on Wall Street in the financial services industry are often the bad guys in police procedurals.
Sure. You know, I mean, I think the sort of rip from the headlines impulse makes them a pretty easy target. And of course, you know, sadly, there are many examples of, of wrongdoing.
Yeah. Well, based on your experience, is that a stereotype?
Wow. I think about the famous Willie Sutton line of, you know, that's where the money is, right?
Hey, Willie Sutton said he was asked why do you rob banks, and he said that's where the money is.
Yeah. I think like so many other phenomena, you know, you can look to the bell-shaped curve, normal distribution, and the people that you find on Wall Street, you know, probably fall into that curve pretty well. I think, you know, at one end, there are people who you could trust in a room with a pile of uncounted money and never think twice that any of it would go missing. Mm-hmm. And at the other end of the spectrum, there are people who, no matter what the safeguards, will always try and game the system. And in the middle is the vast bulk of people who are mostly, under most circumstances, pretty honest. And if the proper regulations and the proper safeguards are in place, are not going to do any more wrong than anybody in any other field. What makes Wall Street interesting, however, and especially on the trading side of things, is you have an industry that has selected and filtered to create a population of people who are very good at coming out on top of zero-sum games. I mean, that's what trading is. You know, it's a zero-sum game. Someone wins and someone loses. And investment banks go out of their way to find people who are really good at playing those games. So the notion that those people, or at least some of those people, aren't going to try and game the compensation system, you know, it's at best a kind of naive notion.
You went to Vassar and won some poetry prizes there.
I did.
So how'd you wind up on Wall Street?
Well, I wrote poetry as an undergraduate, and I was very serious about it and was sort of a hair's breadth away from pursuing an MFA, going into an MFA program. And sort of the 11th hour, I sobered up and realized, you know, I had to pay the rent and I needed to make some money. I actually started in the software business. Mm-hmm. You know, besides studying English at Vassar, I took a lot of math and science courses, physics courses, some computer science courses. So the quantitative side of my education had been well taken care of. And I found a job actually down in D.C. with a small consulting firm that had government contracts, did public policy research, and did big data analyses and statistical analyses on large government databases. That's how I got started.
Mm-hmm. So what happened? Did you rediscover literature or your desire to?
I had never really, lost my interest in it. I, have always been an avid reader and a writer. And really throughout my time on Wall Street and in software, I had written and had been writing poetry and had always been, from a very young age, a fan of crime fiction. And had always thought that, I'd want to try my hand at this. You know, I thank my lucky stars, actually, that I did not go into an MFA program then. Nothing against MFA programs. I was just so young and so inexperienced. And while, I might have had some talent and even some craft, I really have no idea what I would have had to say. You know, I think just, 20 years of some life experience and 20 years of hanging out on trading floors was actually pretty good education for somebody who's interested in watching people and interested in how they behave under pressure and interested in writing crime fiction.
Peter Spiegelman, his new novel, Thick as Thieves. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And the news of the U.S. credit downgrade overtook another important economic story yesterday, the monthly jobless numbers. Only 117,000 jobs were created in July. That's barely enough to make a dent in the unemployment rate. Often overlooked in the monthly job figures are the longer-term employment trends in the United States. Number of people who are long-term unemployed remains unchanged, more than 6 million. Same with the number of discouraged workers, as they're called. Those are people not looking for work because they believe there are no jobs, NPR Sonari Glinton reports.
To understand the unemployment rate, we need to understand the math behind the numbers.
I'm Linda Barrington, a labor economist with the Institute for Compensation Studies at Cornell University.
Professor Barrington is going to help us out. We'll start with fractions. The unemployment number is a fraction. The top number is the numerator, and in this case,
is the number of people who are looking for a job and don't have one.
Then you take that number and divide by the denominator. The number on the bottom
is everybody who is working or wants to be working.
That's where we get the percentage of people who are unemployed, which in July was 9.1%, almost 14 million people. But that's not the whole picture. A lot of people get left out.
People who don't have any interest in working, or the people who have given up because they've looked long enough and they don't expect they're going to get a job, so they just stop.
I know in my gut that finding a full-time job with benefits, for me, the chances are slim to none.
Jan Walsworth turns 60 next week. She's about to become one of those 6 million people who are long-term unemployed. She spent 26 years as a homemaker and minister's wife. Now a divorced grandmother, she lives on a very small pension she got in the divorce. Walsworth was laid off in February from her job in customer service. If you called her up with a computer problem, she could have helped you out.
The thing that maybe has made this all the harder is the fact that that job fulfilled everything that I like to do. I was helping people. A lot of our people that called were older, more my age. I was extremely successful. They could tell by my voice I wasn't some 20-year-old with that impatience.
I met up with Walsworth at a restaurant near the interstate in Jackson, Michigan. She says she hasn't had any serious responses to her job search, and not having work has made her lonely and isolated.
I miss talking to people. I go days sometimes, don't talk to anybody. I want to work again, but I have no real hope of ever doing so in a job that's meaningful to me.
Finding meaningful work, or work that's comparable to what you used to have.
So is it hopeless?
That's a question labor economist Linda Barrington says the long-term unemployed have to be asking.
I think for some people, there is a ratcheting down that's going to have to take place. That may mean taking a pay cut. It may mean going back to school. And these are really difficult decisions.
Barrington says it's not hopeless for the unemployed. They just have to hope for something different. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News. Americans spend more money on music at the online iTunes store than any other music retailer. But there are still many people who don't have a home computer to set up an iTunes account. As NPR's Laura Seidel reports, a company called Cricket is targeting those consumers with its phone-only music service.
The customers who come to this Cricket store in Washington, D.C. want cell phones that connect to the internet to get their email and stay connected to family and friends. But they aren't willing to pay the prices of many of the carriers, and that's why they come here.
It's cheap, and I have four children.
Cynthia Wilson, a medical assistant in D.C., says her sister, who used to be on Sprint, just moved over to Cricket.
She got tired of paying all that money for the same thing she can get here for $55. She was paying $100 and something. That's ridiculous.
And now for an extra $10, customers here can get an unlimited music plan. That appealed to Carlos Duggar.
Because I love my gospel and my jazz.
Duggar says it's his phone, not his computer, that's his main connection to the internet.
do use the phone more for internet purpose than I do at home.
And it's people like Duggar who are not focused on their computers who are the target for Cricket's new music service.
Cricket's customers live on their phone. Their phone, not the computer, is the center of their life.
Jeff Toig developed Cricket's music service. Toig says most of Cricket's customers make $50,000 a year or less. The iPhone probably isn't even an option. Toig admits they could choose other music subscription services that cost $10 a month, names like Napster, Rhapsody, and Spotify. But he says those services all require customers to download an app to their phone first.
And the app is less functional. The experience doesn't start on the phone, it starts on the computer, and the phone is an extension. We have taken a fundamentally different approach because our experience is all about the phone.
Cricket's music service is built in, and it gives its customers access to millions of songs ranging from the work of great gospel singers. To independent artists.
Give up acting tough. It's all that I'm made of.
Two hits from major labels.
I'm beautiful in your way. Just gotta make no mistakes. I'm on the right track today. That I was born this way.
It's surprising in some ways that the big record labels went along with Cricket. They've been notoriously skeptical of online plans. But Michael Nash, a vice president for digital strategies at Warner Music, says the typical Cricket customer burns friends' CDs and listens to radio.
So you've got a situation where you don't have, you know, a great legitimate music proposition, and you don't have a very convenient proposition.
Nash says by creating a music service for the phone, Cricket has tapped into many customers who might not have paid anything at all for digital music. Although the service is phone-based, salespeople at Cricket like to point out that it can easily be used to entertain at home. Sean Burrows, assistant manager at the Cricket store in D.C., shows off a speaker that can connect to the phone.
Kind of like you have a party in your pocket, basically. So this thing is able to, like I said, you get a lot of sound in a small space.
But there are skeptics who don't think this phone really adds much to what's already out there. Amari Love, an analyst at Morningstar, says pretty much all phones now have internet access, and that's really all you need to have a phone with music.
Even playlists, I mean, you can set those up via YouTube. I mean, I can't remember the last handset that didn't have access to that. So it's really about, I'm actually kind of struggling with what real value the Move product is going to add.
And Love thinks there's a limited market for low-cost phone services. However, since Cricket added what it's calling Move Music a little over 5 months ago, it's garnered more than 100,000 users. 50,000 of those customers are completely new to Cricket's phone service. And it may be that in a time when the economy and Americans are struggling, a low-cost service may hit the spot for a growing number of people. Laura Seidel, NPR News.